que necesite.
Oh man, what a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful piece right there from the Strummers, which we'll get into in 1 second, with Cornelius Eady, teacher, philosopher, poet, author, singer, songwriter, Renaissance man all around. Cornelius is laughing in the background here. Are you with us?
I am. Yeah.
It's great to have you on Finn's Revolution on WUSB, a place that you employs you on occasion.
Yes. Twice in my life. Yes, absolutely.
At your professor and teacher and all of the above, and teacher in many ways, and an activist and thinker. Now, before we go wide and go wherever things take us, we just listened to the Money Mississippi Blues, which is a somewhat known poem by Mr. Langston Hughes, and a great thinker and activist, much like yourself. And want to tell us a little about the story of this particular song and how it came about as a song.
Well, I don't know how well-known it actually is. Actually, I didn't know about its existence until I went to tape a segment for a radio show that the BBC was doing on Emmett Till.
Mm-hmm.
And I got into the studio, and I have a poem that got published in the New Yorker about Emmett Till. It's about Emmett Till's casket. And that was the connection for the BBC to get me into the, that program, into that project. But when I got there, they gave me this lyric, and they said, well, Langston wrote this. It might have been published someplace, but Langston wrote this after Emmett Till was murdered. Mm-hmm. And they told me that that lyric had been set to blues music. There was a blues musician who set the lyric to music, but the music was lost.
Hmm.
Now, I didn't believe that. I mean, I still don't quite believe that, because this is America, so my guess is that's in some manila folder, in some trunk, somewhere. Somebody doesn't know what they've got, right?
That's right. Either there's a reel of tape, or it's just some paper, right? Exactly.
Well, right, a reel of tape, or a lead sheet, you know,
right.
Something, right. Somewhere, somebody's got this, right? But as far as the BBC was concerned, it was a lost melody. So I think they were kind of inferring that, suggesting that maybe I should set a melody to it. And so they gave me the lyric, as you can tell, it's a powerful lyric. I decided not to set it as a blues, because I felt that if I set it as a blues and they finally find that music, it's going to sound so lame, okay? So, and also, you know, I thought I'd bring it into the 2000s, right?
Sure.
So I set a new melody on dulcimer, and then I was around that time. I was teaching at Southampton in the Southampton Writers Conference, and my graduate assistant was Sarah Zara,
mm-hmm.
who I found out. During the first couple of days there, was a fantastic singer and musician and writer in her own right. So after I set up the melody, the idea occurred to me that maybe Sarah would like to, you know, join me on this. So I invited her to come and sit. She added acoustic guitar and the vocals that you hear on that track, which are absolutely gorgeous.
Mm.
That was actually the launching of the Strummers.
Okay, and that's a pretty auspicious launching.
Oh yes,
yeah.
It's a great track, and actually, in some ways, it marks the sort of shifting away from, not shifting away from, but the first recording I've done in about 5 or 6 years with somebody outside of the Rough Magic orbit. Right. And I mean, the people I've been recording with, Charlie Rao and Lisa Liu, and Robin Messing and all the other people that were in and Rough Magic. This is the first project I've done outside of the Rough Magic orbit.
Hmm. Which makes it exciting and a different just a different take on things and a different inputs.
Yeah,
that's beautiful. And I have to tell you, I've been listening to this release for a little bit, even before you sent it to me. Had a little access, shall we say? We won't go into that. But
okay.
It's quite lovely and haunting and beautiful, and the whole project is really, really great.
Well, thank you. I mean,
yeah.
Sarah, I have to give props to Sarah Zera, who is just an incredible singer and musician, and she really brings it to this project. I was totally moved by what she came up with, and it was really a great. It was the time to have this kind of thing. The strummers are kind of like a pun of on the Weavers, right?
Right.
So. And I have a lot of old songs that were political and stuff like that. And I suddenly realized that old catch of songs would probably fit the strummers, right? So,
sure.
So a lot of those songs are songs that I wrote back in the 1990s during my first life at Stony Brook, to tell you the truth. Divided City, for example, one of the tracks that comes after the Langston Hughes track, something that I wrote for June Jordan, who was the director of the Poetry Center at Stony Brook at the time, and I just wanted, it was just this thing that I was teaching at I was guest teaching at Sarah Lawrence College at that time, and something had gone on. There was a student strike that they wanted more representation from writers of color, in the school, and there was something about, there was a NIMBY kind of thing going on in mm-hmm. Brownsville. So those two things combined to make that track, and I was thinking of June when I wrote that song.
Mm.
So there's a lot of connection between old Stony Brook and my old life at Stony Brook, my new life at Stony Brook.
And plus the name of the outfit is the Strummers, which is also references another political guy, Joe Strummer,
Sarah's mom,
right.
is Shirley Strum Kenny.
Right.
So all those things are attached to the title. Yeah,
it's all weavered in, as they say.
Yes, not bad, Finn. Pretty good.
I don't know if it was pretty good, but thank you very much.
It worked.
You're very kind. So let's talk a little about your background for those of our listeners who are not familiar. We are talking to Cornelius Eady, and he is writer, poet, and most of us who are into poetry and Cornelius may not know, but I do have poets on this show on a regular basis, so you're not alone. But most people who listen to this program are fans of poetry in some manner or another, and a lot of people have Hard-Headed Weather on their shelves, and including myself, and something I certainly go back to on a regular basis. And let's talk a little about your personal history and how you got involved with, first of all, writing, because I think that's the deep love here, right?
Yes, it is. It is. Poetry is always the
spark.
The spark, the center of everything else that I do. And I've been writing since I was a teenager. I'm actually from upstate New York. I'm from Rochester. And I just sort of, like most writers, you suddenly, I think at some point, realized that I was very, that there was a aptitude for that, right?
Mm-hmm.
That sort of worked better than anything else. I was very lucky. I think I've said this many times, but if you scratch the surface of most writers, at some point you will find the teacher, right?
Mm-hmm.
The high school teacher or the person in junior college or the person when they were undergrads, that one person that changed the direction of their stream, so to speak. And I had a really great homeroom teacher in my high school in Rochester, New York. And I was scratching away at it. I mean, the thing about writing was that at that time I was thinking about it in terms of songwriting. Songwriting and lyrics and poetry are kind of sort of like something I've been doing since I was a teenager. And I wrote pretty, what I would consider now, dry lyrics, right? I didn't know how to play guitar well at that time, so I basically just sort of, they were like lyrics without music to them. And, you know, but poems. And one of those happened to be a poem that I wrote about Martin Luther King, after he was assassinated, the year he was assassinated. That high school teacher was also the editor of the literary magazine for the high school. And once that poem got published, I realized what the power of speaking your truth in a poem could do. It was a large high school, maybe 500-600 people in it, 300-400 people in it, and I was, you know, and once the literary magazine came out, people who I'd never met in that school with this, I could hear people whispering behind my back as I walked through the halls, oh, that's that guy, that's the poet. You know?
Right, it's that recognition that all of a sudden is the encouragement.
Right, and that was the hook, I think. So that leads to going to the library and reading a lot of books and just writing, you know, pretty much for myself and my friends. And then I saw a notice in one of the sort of like culture magazines in Rochester at the time. They were announcing that there was a writing workshop, poetry workshop, that was just looking for new people. That was my entry into literature. That was my entry into the poetry world. Up to that point, I had no idea. I mean, I read poetry books, and you know, but I didn't know there was something. There was a whole sort of world of literature out there, and that workshop was the door into that world. And after that, also, not only was it good because I started to learn the tenets of how to do a poetry workshop, but it was also. Most of the people in that workshop worked in the Poets in the Schools program, and so they trained me in the Poets in the Schools program that paid awful well later on. It also gave me the idea that suddenly I might have a chance of getting a really good low-paying job, you know, that would revolve around you know writing as opposed to you know packing you know boxes in a truck.
Wow, that's it. You know, the fact that that's something we find out here on Long Island very often, and you're familiar with the area. But I mean, something we find very often is that so many people feel that they are starved for the culture and either a window into the arts world in some manner, to the creative soul. And what it is it's actually out there and it's all around you. There are active poets. There are things happening, and you just have to find them and become aware of them. It's not that they're not happening. It's that they are happening. They're just not covered, let's say, by, you know, Newsday page 2. So
yeah.
And it's all out here. And the artistic life, the creative life is all around us. And, you know, everyone always says Long Island, dearth of culture, blah, blah, blah. But it's not true. It's out here and it's everywhere. Yeah.
Good Lord. I mean, come on. Lou Reed died there, okay?
That's right. I mean, Lou Reed lived in Freeport, baby. That's it.
He's from Long Island and he died on Long Island. So come on, all right?
Matter of fact, just before you came on, we just did our Lou Reed ID, as a matter of fact. So there you go.
No kidding. That's great. But of course, Walt Whitman came from Long Island. Lou Reed was from Long Island. I mean, we can go on and on about this.
Exactly.
And you're right. It's one of those things that basically, you know, I really believe that you need the arts. You need that part of that nourishment is something that you really need. It's essential as water or air and food, you know.
Yeah.
If you don't have it, you starve. And, I really feel that, of course, Long Island, you know, is filled with the arts. It was the first time I was at Stony Brook, is even more so now, where I'm teaching now at the campus on Southampton.
Right.
It's just an incredible beehive of activity there. So, that was one of the things. When June Jordan did the Poetry Center, when she invented
at Stony Brook, right?
Mm-hmm. At Stony Brook, on the main campus, part of the, I think, part of her mission, part of the point she was trying to make, was that she wanted to have a reading series that was going to be just as exciting and interesting and varied as anything you'd get in Manhattan, you know? That's the point she's trying. You don't have to get in the car, you don't have to get on the train, you don't have to go off to someplace else. You can actually come to Stony Brook and get world-class, you know, poetry, you know, right? It's on the island. Not only is it on the island, and you can actually sort of like have a showcase, a spotlight on those writers. You also have a magnet that sort of attracted, you know, those poets to the center.
Right.
And the roster of people who have gone and read at the Poetry Center at Stony Brook is really impressive. If you go through that list, your mouth would drop open.
Yeah.
So nothing to apologize for.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So just, you know, the bottom line is to our listeners, just keep your ears to the ground and just be open and go out and support this stuff. You know, there's open mics. There's a whole bunch of things that happen on the very local level, including, you know, larger, more popular kinds of readings. But, you know, go out there and support it. And it's most of it's free, and just go out and do it.
Yep.
You buy a cup of coffee. That's what you do with a lot of these things,
yes,
right?
I know. Yeah, so much of it is free. I mean, that,
right.
You know, yeah, it is.
And you're immersed in the culture, and it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, it is.
So let's talk a little. Let's go back to the musical aspect of thing. Well, first of all, let's stick with poetry for one second. Let's talk about your personal influences as you developed. Who did you see, when you look back, even if you didn't necessarily see it at the time, as a major thrust in your writing?
Well, there's tons of writers. I mean, when you talk that, when you ask that question to a poet, it really is an anthology. It is.
Yeah.
You know, it isn't just normally, mostly, it's not just one poet. You know, though I do sometimes challenge my students when I do my workshop. I ask them that question. You know,
right,
the poet that kicked you, right? What? Because there was some. Somewhere in the mix, there was one poet that basically, you know, shook you so much that your only response was to get a pen and paper and start writing. Right?
Right. So who's yours?
Reply. So, but the truth of the matter is, as that old saying goes, it takes a village to raise a, you know, a kid.
Yeah.
It takes a library to raise a poet. You know, and I really do believe this. I mean, it's like, you know, I can tell you, take the entire hour talking about the different ways that reading has influenced the way I was writing, right? And it's not just one moment, right? But I can give an example when I was just married and my wife was finishing her undergrad degree at Princeton, and I got a job in the Firestone Library, as a shelver for 2 years. But the shelvers got was a passkey. So you get all the stacks, you get to go into the carrels and take the books out and something. There were books there are books in the Princeton, you know, University Library that no one ever checked out, but I went crazy. I wrote my first book at the library, right? So all of those influences, you know, came into play, right? And of course, you know, this is just at the end of the Black Arts Movement. So people like Mary Baraka, whose book The Lecturer was a really big influence on me, influence in a lot of ways. Influence in a sense that I was seeing as really sophisticated urban writer, right? That looked kind of like wasn't quite my age, older than me, but a black writer, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that meant a lot to me. And also his connection to the Beats were very interesting because I was also reading the Beats, right?
Mm-hmm.
Gall McConnell had a great influence on me. W.S. Merwin, who just died,
mm-hmm.
had a great influence on me, though I did not write like him. I mean, there's a certain kind of thing about reading that I believe, that, at least for me, it was basically, there were writers like Basil Bunting, like W.S. Merwin, that I just simply just adored, but knew instinctively that I would not go in that direction, right?
Mm-hmm.
So part of what you get is part of the shaping is the poets that you admire, but you get some of the osmosis from them, but you're not going to go in that direction because that's not what you're interested in. I was more interested in the poets Amir Baraka, like June mm-hmm. Jordan, like Sonia Sanchez, you know. I mean, there was this orbit of poets that were very craft oriented, but very social. And that group of poets was something that really spoke to me as a young poet.
Hmm.
So I started to also get my, I think in some ways I started to form what my thesis of being a poet was going to be about, right? That the poet was going to have, you know, craft, but also this idea that something about the idea of social voice was very mm-hmm. important. That the poet's duty to their community was also very important. That the idea of actually speaking out for on behalf was also very important.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that part of it started back in high school when I wrote the Martin Luther King poem and people started responding to that. Part of the response to me was to the poem, I should say, was basically, I'm so glad you said that. I was thinking that, but I couldn't say it.
Right.
It was a horrible poem. Don't get me wrong; it was a bad poem. I would die from embarrassment if I see the poem now. But it hit a nerve, right? You
yeah.
say I wanted to say that, and you said that for me, right? So I think in some ways that might have been the small beginnings of the turning of the wheels towards that direction.
Yeah, and speaking, you know, I mean, your poetry goes many ways in different times, depending on what you're writing. From what I've read, and it's do you feel a responsibility as a social activist poet?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Could you explain a little? Does that tug at you at different times? Do you feel the responsibility and write? Do you write and find that responsibility? Do you know what I mean?
I know what you mean. Yeah.
What is your process as far as living up to that? What you feel you should be doing?
Well, it is. I mean, as I was saying, it's a combination of craft and then subject, right?
Right?
I also believe there are different poetries in the world. When people start talking about poetry, it's not thinking about this one size fits all, and it doesn't. There are many poetries in the world. There's no such thing as American poetry. There's American poetries, different mm-hmm. camps, different styles, different techniques, and I think that my duty as a poet is to simply sometimes. Sometimes you're a megaphone. Sometimes, I mean, one of the things I think, especially in these days, that I totally think this is a really silly thing to say. This idea of preaching to the choir. You can't preach to the prior.
Right.
The prior needs to be as a counterbalance to all the other nonsense that's going on outside there. I mean, we have a president right now that every time he comes. Every time he comes on television, every time he sits in front of a microphone, every time he has to do a speech, it's BS.
Right.
It's a lie, right?
He's sort of the anti-poet.
Yes, he is. He's anti-everything, you know. But language is he murders language.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I mean.
Right?
Yes.
So preaching the choir to me in these days to be like, oh, no, you need to preach to the choir. You need to let people know, no, you have to. You know, you really, there is another way of saying things. There is something about language that has to be, you know, defended here, you know?
Right.
So I think the duty, one duty of the poet is exactly that, to be a counterbalance to this idea of this nonsense, this idea of alternative realities, this idea of, you know, whatever you want to say, but, but also you're part of a community, and you don't want to feel bound to it or tied to it in such a way that you won't get to have the right to do whatever you need to go. But I don't think you should also pretend that you're not living in the world. that there's art and then there's politics and there's no such thing. I mean, people die from politics. Okay.
Right.
So from my point of view, the poet has to be alert, has to be in the world, has to notice the world that they are in, and also bring that truth or that observation, to their page.
The job of the artist.
The job of the artist, yeah.
Yeah. We are, it's about 8:31 in the p.m. right now here on WUSB Stony Brook. You're listening to Finn's Revolution, and we are talking to poet, activist, singer, songwriter, all around good guy. Cornelius Seedy, right here on WUSB. I'm thrilled to have him on the air with us. Let's discuss in our limited time here, Cornelius, some more music. I do note that on the Strummer's new release, in which you, as we discussed a little earlier, kind of rework a Langston Hughes poem, "The Money Mississippi Blues," with a beautiful melody and some beautiful music that my good friend Conchetta is playing with you as well.
Yes, Charlie Rell and Conchetta, which is really wonderful. Conchetta is on one of the tracks for the on the Strummers, and Conchetta was one of the founding members of Rough Magic.
Yep.
The band I was with, Charlie Rell, was in.
Yep.
And with me and Charlie Rell and Lisa Liu after Conchetta left the band.
Yep.
But after Conchetta left the band, we still kept doing projects together. So Conchetta has just been wonderful companion, musical companion, and Charlie as well.
Conchetta, stunning creative violinist.
Oh my God,
she's been on the show a few times. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we have our own. I didn't want to overload you, but I actually had another project I did with Conchetta the same time that Strummers came out. It's called Bowen Verse, that's another. That's a whole other 11 track. Project that I did with Conchetta, and it was so much fun to do this with Conchetta. Besides the fact that she's a great composer and a really fantastic player, she's also a fantastic singer.
And she's fun.
And she's fun. Yes, yes. It's just a lot of fun to be around. It wasn't a chore to do that that project with her. She's a fantastic artist. She really is.
Yeah, and of course, for a few years now, Charlie has been tugging at my sleeve, singing your praises, and turning me on to things that you've been doing, and that you guys have been doing together. And I think that it's like a match made in heaven with you two playing together when you do.
I feel so incredibly lucky that I ran into and I stumbled upon this little cadre of musicians.
Yeah.
These days it's kind of like having a stock company, up until last December, whenever I had to do music, it had to be somebody in that circle. It'd be Charlie, or Charlie and Lisa, or it'd be me and Conchetta, or me and Robin, or something. It'd always be some sort of combination of the Rough Magic thing, But that's because they're such great players. I don't feel the desire to go outside of that circle, right? I don't need to go outside of that circle because they're such incredible players.
And they play to the song. They play to the song.
They play to the song. They're so sympathetic. They're so supportive and sensitive to the lyric. I've been in a couple of rock bands over the years of my life, but the joke I say about Rough Magic is that I had to wait for them to grow up. I had to wait for my band to grow up to get to play with them, right? I mean, and that's pretty much it. I mean, you know, when I was doing my other stuff, and you know, there's like two orbits I've got. One is the Rough Magic Orbit, and the other orbit is in Rochester, where I had another band called called Swamp Rose, which was a kind of a pop folk kind of thing. Country kind of thing, and you know, there was those four people up until Rough Magic were the only people I dealt with when I was going to do music, but then thanks to Robin Messing, who is the daughter of the bass player Emma Alabaster, I suddenly got a door opened into the stuff. The project that really started us off was. Was something called Book of Hooks, which was a two CD project that I did with Kenny Wampus Press. The first thing I ever did with Kenny Wampus Press, and I was inviting people in, through, and I needed a guitarist, and I thought I needed a violin on a certain track, and I didn't want to do a sample of anything, and I asked Robin, who was. I've known for years, you know, but it was a fantastic singer and a novelist, and is a great writer as well. I asked her if she knew anybody who could play a good bass part, or you knew anybody who could play a guitar, because the guitarist I was using at the time couldn't do it, right? Because he was out doing something else, and Robin sent me a video of Charlie and Conchetta, who were then playing. As a duo,
yeah,
and I just thought, oh my god, these guys are really great. So I used them for a track. I also used Emma for a track, and to my shame, I tell the story as shame upon myself, right? but when Robin mentioned that she had her daughter Emma come play a bass part for me, my first horrible thought was. Proud mama, right? Right?
No, naturally, right? Yeah.
My daughter is a bass player, and her name is Emma Alabaster, which I thought she made up, right? Not true. I mean, Robin married a guy whose last name is Alabaster, so I thought she was doing this goth thing. I'm Alabaster. I was waiting for this horn. Emma shows up, right? And for the part of the song, and she just. The playing on the song is absolutely astonishing. She transforms the entire song, right? Then her partner, Leo Ferguson, who's also a drummer, I got invited to do a reading, opening for Oliver Lake, in a church in downtown Manhattan. And first I said no, and then I thought about it. I just finished doing the session with Charlie and Lisa, right? Charlie and Conchetta. And I really had a great time with those two. I mean, they were just, you know how they are. They're just great people.
Yes.
Hanging well, that was just a lot of fun. And so I thought about it, and I called the organizer back, and I said to the organizer, well, you know what? If I could, I'll do it if I can get my band to play a couple of songs after I read a few poems.
All right.
I didn't have a band.
But you don't have to. You just have to say it.
Right. I wanted to see if I could play with Charlie and Conchetta, right? So I called them all up. I said, look, here's the deal. You know, there's not a lot of money, but there's this gig, and we're getting to open for Oliver Lake. Not too shabby.
Right.
You know, luckily the calendars were all, the schedules were all in alignment, so we rehearsed a couple of times. We did that. We did the gig. It felt really good. Then we got an invitation to play at another place at a bookstore. The second gig was when Rough Magic got born. We just liked it so much. It was just sort of really apparent. But Conchetta was the person who actually put the period there, put the end stop on. She came over to record some parts of me a couple days later. And she said, "Well, we're a project now, right?"
Right. I can hear that coming out of her mouth. Yes.
Yeah, we're a project now, right? And I said, "Yeah, we're a project." You know, and that's the way it's been for the last 6-7 years.
How cool is that? How cool
it's
is that to
cool.
find people you can work with and they just pick it up and it's like family, you know?
I know. Well, the other great thing about them, I hope they'll take offense with this, but when the bands, they'll be listening.
Don't worry about it.
Yeah. But the bands that I've been in before all this, so disorganized. So, these guys Total professional. Show up when they say they're going to show up. They show up. You know, show up pretty much.
That's because they're in demand, and that's right. And they know that their time is precious, and your time is precious.
Yeah,
and
it's very
professional. Yes.
Yeah, I was like, wow, these guys are serious. These are really great musicians, and I felt incredibly lucky.
I'll tell you right now, I've seen Charlie in very loud bars, okay, doing his thing, you know, his beautiful, quiet, delicate, gorgeous stuff, his songs that are like a minute long in some cases.
Yes.
Right, well, really, you know. And the bar gets quiet, and these guys drinking beers at the bar turn their heads, and they're paying attention.
Yeah.
You know, and Charlie's got that power. He's a gifted guy.
He's that intense. He really is. I totally get that. I mean,
yeah.
You suddenly go, it isn't a guy strumming a guitar. You know, I mean, it really is. This guy comes in and this is beautifully constructed melody. Very constructed song.
So,
you know,
So let's discuss what's coming up for you. Obviously, you have these two releases among obviously other things happening.
Yeah.
You have the thing with the strummers, and you also have this other project with Charlie, as we just discussed, something you recorded very recently at Sun Studios in Memphis.
Right.
Want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely.
Tell us how that all came about.
Well, that's thanks to Lisa Liu, who is the other guitarist in the trio. And again, a gypsy guitarist, and
yep.
My God. You know, mind-blowingly good, you know?
Yep.
Lisa went down to Memphis, with her wife, they just hung out, and I guess they did the tour of Sun Studio, but Lisa being Lisa, just got in good with the engineers there, right? And came back for rehearsal a couple of like week later, and just said, "My God, you gotta go!" I hope I'm not getting this wrong, but I remember I think she was wearing a Sun T-shirt, you know. And she was just like, "You gotta go! This is fantastic! This place is fantastic! We gotta record here! We've got to record here!" And you know, we talked it over, and then went to Sammy Greenberg, the publisher of Kalewampa Press. And said, it's another project. Can we get you go down and do this? And she's, thank God for Sammy. Sammy's been the guardian angel of all this music. And I'm glad I have a moment to actually talk about her briefly because she's just been, you know, she's the reason the music is out in the world. You know,
which is great. Yeah,
which is fantastic. And she said, fine. Yeah, let's do it. So last November we flew down. We had a fantastic, 48 hours in Memphis. We flew down. During the day, the studio is a museum.
Right.
During the evening, it's still a working studio.
Which is amazing, right?
Which is amazing. And it's that room,
yeah.
Right? One of the many things that struck me about that was that room is like there's a little anteroom as you go in off the street, but that's it. That stuff was recorded almost on the street, you know?
Right.
There's a working street that's going back, traffic going back and forth and everything, and you just go through the door, and you go through another door, and then you're in that studio. And that studio, it's still that room, right? I mean, there's some pictures on the wall that shows you that Jerry Lee Lewis was there and Elvis was there.
Yeah, but the room is the same.
But the room is pretty much the same as when they were recording, and a lot of the equipment is still there.
Right.
You know, I was just gobsmacked being there.
Oh yeah, I can imagine.
It's that room and the air in that room and the way that Sam Phillips designed that room. It was so. That room was designed so acoustically perfect that we were recording without headphones. We were just in the room. We had mics on our instruments, mics on my vocal, and that was it. We didn't.
Wow.
There was no monitor. There was no headphones. That room is so good. You actually hear each other that well. I mean, the guy was a the guy was a genius, it was funny.
And yet simple, right?
Well, that's what it was. I mean, that's what it was. It really sort of like, it's there for the voice and there for the instruments, nothing fussy, nothing fancy,
I was talking to Charlie actually about the recording session from his perspective there, and that's how he felt. He thought it was just a magic location, and you guys just, it was just like a magic time, so.
Oh, in some ways, I think that was the project we've been working up to all along, This is the third project of ours, and I think it's what we've been working towards. It is actually a beautiful set of songs, and it just sounds incredibly. It sounds incredible.
Yeah.
And I'm really, so we're going to release that next fall. We're going to release it at the Princeton Poetry Festival.
Oh, wow. How cool.
Yeah. And so we're working towards that. We're getting buzz and people, trying to get people, involved. But that's where it's going to be released. It's going to be released at Princeton Poetry Festival, I think, in October, next October.
Okay. So Cornelius Eady, what is next for you right now as far as you have readings coming up, musical performances? What's going on?
Well, in April in Austin, they're going to do a week-long festival based on my poetry cycle, Brutal Imagination, which is a poetry cycle on the murderer of Susan Smith, who murdered her two kids and then blamed the black man on the crime until the story got busted.
Listen, that's what culture does. They always blame the black man, so you know.
Well,
that's
he's a golem, right? I mean,
that's
the whole thing. There's going to be panels on it. There's going to be a theatrical version of it. One-person theatrical version of it that I did not write, but it's been adapted by these students, right? And they called me up and they said, "Well, we'd like you to come down and be part of this." And I said, "Wow, you guys are really doing this." I mean, okay, it's not the play. It's not the play that I did. It's going to be a total reimagining of what it is. I can't wait.
How
to see
amazing!
What they're gonna do. Yeah, so that's going to be in like mid-April, I think, from the 14th to the 19th, and the week that weekend, I'm actually going to launch another music project that I didn't write the music for, but was done with a musician named John Mills that I met at a festival the year before in Round Top, Texas. And he's a saxophone player. He's a really great player and arranger. When we did our reading there at Round Top, he actually rehearsed doing some music, put some music behind some of the readings for the poets that evening. And when we rehearsed, I did one thing, when it came time to perform, I suddenly realized these guys improvise. This is what they do, the jazz players. So I simply tossed them something and I kept playing with it, right? John, I think, was so impressed by what I was doing that he actually invited me to do a project with him. And a couple months later, he flew to Brooklyn, and we recorded, I think, around about maybe a dozen poems that he then, and basic tracks that he put down, and he finished it off. So we're going to launch that project.
That's an exciting project. That's exciting.
Yeah.
Wow. Cornelius, unfortunately, we're just about out of time here, but we could do a 3-hour show one night. We have to do that.
Happy to do it.
You're constantly busy. You're a creative force. It's an amazing thing, and your work is meaningful and strong. And you're just all over the map and doing great, great work. And I cannot. Where can people pick up copies of the music? Is there a site they can go to?
Oh yeah, you can go.
Poetry readings.
You can go to Bandcamp and get the Strummers, and you can go to SoundCloud and you can get the some of the projects I've done with Charlie and Lisa. You can also get Bandcamp. You also can get the Strummers, and you can also get the project Bow and Verse that I did with Conchetta.
All right, so basically you guys have to check out Cornelius Eady. That's E-A-D-Y last name, Cornelius first name. In case you're not familiar and it's the first time you're hearing about him, and if it is, your ears should have opened up, man, because this is happening, you know, and it's great, great writer. Check out his books. You can check him out on Amazon. You can check him out anywhere you want. They're everywhere. And but check him out on Bandcamp so you can hear some of this material we're discussing tonight. Cornelius, I want to thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you for inviting me. I truly enjoyed it. Thank you.
Finn's Revolution, and say hello to all my friends who never talk to me.
You know what? I'm seeing Charlie and Lisa tomorrow, so I'll tell them hi for you, okay?
And I think right now we're going to hear one of my favorite tracks from the forthcoming Cornelius Eady Trio release that's coming up in the fall. And this is called The Pickle King. And, absolutely, yes.
Quickly, the story of The Pickle King.
Go ahead.
Very quickly, if you have time. Pickle King is a true story about a slave that that was on, you know, that the master sold him to the railroad, to, not sold him, but lent him to the railroad to do some work. And he understood, John Bolton understood, that was a road. So he just walked away. He walked down the rails to the Union lines and then, you know, and then gave the Union information about how they can come in and take the town, right? Then he came back and rescued his wife from, you know, from the plantation, right? Same way, you know? And after the war, he moves to Long Island, okay?
See?
The man moves to Long Island and he becomes renowned for pickles.
Well, there you go.
So it's a Long Island story in a way.
It's like the Pickle Railroad, the Underground Pickle Railroad.
That's right.
Cornelius Eady, thanks so much for joining us on Finn's Revolution at WUSB, my friend. And we'll see you very soon, and we'll have you on again, all right?
All right, I'm looking forward to it.
All right, man. See you later. Bye.
All right, sure. Bye-bye.
Stop walking to the RFP. I won't stop walking till I'm free. Gonna stop walking to the RFP. I won't stop walking until I'm free. Gonna stop working for Mr. Marmaduke. He gave my sweat to the railroad. The rails are iron, but they hate chains. And never see my face again. Gonna stop walking to the RFP. I won't stop until I'm free. Gonna stop walking till the IFP. I won't stop walking until I'm free. Take that pickaxe and haul away. He gave my sweat to the railroad. My feet sprout wings and flew away. My feet will have the final say.